Let's begin. The last time that we met, and it's not necessary to have been here, no worries. The last time that we met, the issue that we discussed was the question of where, given the fact that we have spent many classes excavating the Jewish identity of the, first of all, in an individuated sense, the early founders of Christianity, Jesus, of what would later come to be understood as Christianity, Jesus, Paul, and of the texts, many of the texts of early Christian, the early Christian corpus, as it were, for instance, Paul's letters, Paul's authentic letters at least, and some other texts. How is it that it comes to be that, or what are the first literary steps that we can identify towards a Christianity or a Jesus following that sees at its that sees Jews not at its center but at its periphery, and in fact sees Gentiles or some other concocted identity at its center? We located the earliest sort of form of that narrative, as it were, in the sort of two-part work that can be found in what we now know as the New Testament, called Luke-Acts. It was Luke and the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts are written by the same person, and Acts is sort of a sequel to Luke. So we saw in that book how the narrative strategy that the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts employs in setting out the course of history after the death and then the apparent resurrection of Jesus is calculated to take us, take the reader from seeing Jews at the center and Jews and Judaism at the center of the story of Jesus' followers to seeing Jews and Judaism at the margins of the story and seeing, in fact, Gentiles at the center of the story. That's the strategy that Luke employs. All the while maintaining, and the question of when this stops is going to entertain us in 2 weeks' time, but all the while affirming that for Jews who are followers of Jesus, keeping Jewish law is an absolutely binding requirement. And in fact, the example par excellence of a Jew committed to Jesus' message who kept the law punctiliously would be Jesus himself and Paul. Those would be the two examples of that. But as the narrative moved on, we saw how Jews and Jewish symbols in Judaism and Jerusalem are displaced more and more from the center of the narrative towards the periphery. And as we saw, the narrative culminates with Paul ending up in Rome, despairing of ever really connecting with the Jewish community there and affirming, at least as the gospel tells it, that salvation is going to be is going to come to the Gentiles, and that's going to be the way things are going to happen. We saw, we noted that this is not, Luke Acts is not preserving sort of what we might call the historical Paul's views. Luke Acts is an interpretation of Paul's writings, and not necessarily the correct interpretation, at least as far as we can reconstruct. But in any event, that's the narrative that we saw in the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts. So now, the question that I want to ask this week is, what's the counter-narrative? And by counter-narrative, we don't necessarily need to assume that there was a counter-narrative, maybe there wasn't, but I'm going to argue that actually in the text we looked at last time, there is already a pointer in the text that we saw, that there is a counter-narrative, and we're going to have to ask ourselves what it is, where it comes from, where it instantiates, and why we care about it as 21st century Jews. Okay.
In your whole discussion, you've left out any mention of the fact that the destruction of the Second Temple, the law diminished the significance of Judaism in others' eyes.
Well, you can argue that
it's like a defeated people.
Right, so that's an interesting question. So the way that I would phrase this and the way that historians generally phrase that is, was the destruction of the temple in the year 70 CE thereabouts a watershed? That's what you can put it. In fact, there's a really wonderful collection of essays by a bunch of historians that came out just a few years ago with the title, "Was 70 CE a Watershed?" The conclusion, by and large, was no. And that's where And that's, in fact, where I think the best scholars are moving nowadays, towards a recognition that the destruction of the temple, while certainly a catastrophe in a political sense, in a national sense, in a spiritual sense, at least in terms of the immediate effect that it had on Jewish life and Jewish practice, the development of Jewish law, the development of Jewish literature, was in some cases certainly very much felt, but in other cases, especially in rabbinic literature, and in some of the material evidence that survives from that period, doesn't seem to have been as momentous an event as you would imagine. And in fact, when it comes to rabbinic literature, the real effects of the absence of the temple are not really felt in rabbinic literature until several hundred years later, you know, like the end of the Tannaitic period, sort of the beginning of the 3rd century CE. But I don't want that question to detain us too much now, because I really want to push on ahead. But I will note that that in fact, the question of how much our sort of New Testament texts that we're interested in are interested in the destruction of the temple is really a live question. In the Gospels, Jesus is said to sort of at least possibly predict the destruction of the temple. And the temple is, of course, a major locus of activity, of Jesus' activity and his disciples' activities. It's not clear to me, though, from a plain reading of the texts that that really a lot turns on the destruction of the temple. And this is especially so if the Gospels, or at least most of the at least Matthew and Luke, were composed, as scholars tend to suspect, after the destruction of the temple. It really doesn't seem to have been the turning point, as you might expect. But that's actually a question that maybe we should return to at a later date, because it really is a significant challenge. Why wasn't it the catastrophe that we, I think, now assume that it was, and that in many respects it really was in reality. But let's leave that for a moment. What I want to do now is take a look at the first source here from the book of Acts. This was a passage that we looked at last time, but we really breezed through it, and I want to give it some more tender, loving care right now. The book of Acts in chapter 15, just to refresh your memory from last week, this is a pivotal moment in the book of Acts, and it's referred to sort of by theologians and historians as the chapter that documents the so-called Council of Jerusalem and the Apostolic Decrees. And what those refer to is basically the following. So there, according to the narrative of Acts, there's this big machlokas, this big dispute between Paul and his colleagues, on the one hand, and some other factions, especially James and James's disciples, and Peter is somehow caught in the middle. On the other hand, over to what degree must Gentile followers of Jesus be expected to keep Jewish law? And perhaps a corollary of this is, should they be expected to convert? So according to the narrative of Luke and Acts, this all comes to a head in Jerusalem, and there's this big convocation where everybody gets together, hashes out this question, and the ruling that is pronounced, the apostolic decree that emerges from this council at Jerusalem, which it's not clear from Paul's writing that such a thing ever took place, and even if it did, if it took place in this fashion. But at least in the narrative of Acts, everybody's sort of, the maskana that everybody comes to, the conclusion that everybody reaches is, Paul's right, let's just let Paul be Paul. This is very, and as we saw last time, right after that, the narrative really trains its attention squarely on Paul, and Peter sort of recedes into the periphery and eventually is never heard from again in the rest of the gospel, in the rest of Acts. So, what I want to ask now is, in the prelude, what sets off the conflict that leads to the Council of Jerusalem? So take a look at this source here. So this is what Acts chapter 15 tells us. Then certain individuals came down from Judea and were teaching the brothers, namely the followers of Jesus, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Okay. And this is what really sets off Paul, and Paul strenuously objects to this. So, the original controversy at the root of the Council of Jerusalem was what? Circumcision, right? And in fact, in Paul's writings, he refers to the circumcision group, to the people who opposed him, as we're going to see in a moment, were the circumcision guys. That's who they were. So it's this controversy over circumcision, which is, of course, the marker par excellence of Jewish identity, at least for males, that was at stake here. The result of all of this is that James, who in Paul's writings, seems to be the person whose authority these circumcision folks are claiming, at least in the book of Acts, is said to have decided the following. So James said, "Therefore I have reached the decision that we should not trouble those Gentiles who are turning to God. They don't have to get circumcised, but we should write to them to abstain only from things polluted by idols, from fornication, and from whatever has been strangled, and from blood." So what does James say here? What is James's sort of resolution to this whole problem? So what about circumcision?
No circumcision.
You have to keep a few things. Now, the source for these few things is a contentious issue, and we may deal with that at a later point if we have time. But regardless, nobody has to keep Jewish law in toto. You just have to keep these few things. But you certainly don't have to become Jewish. You certainly don't have to be circumcised. And kal v'chomer, as we might say, or sort of a fortiori, you don't have to keep the entire complex of Jewish law. Okay, you don't have to be Jewish. Okay. Now, what this tells us, now, in the book of Acts, this settles the issue, according to the narrative of the book of Acts. And we're left to wonder, who were these people, these certain individuals who came down from Judea, who were they? What did they think? What sort of Jesus, what sort of characterized their following of Jesus? So in fact, yes?
So on this last part of what they do need to do,
yes,
refraining from whatever has been strangled them from blood, is that referring to dietary?
Yes, those are certain dietary restrictions, both in terms of certain dietary restrictions. Okay. Now, in fact, if you look at Paul's own writings, so for example, the letter to the Galatians, which is one of the authentic letters of Paul, there are text critical issues, but it's one of the authentic letters of Paul. Paul himself actually seems to indicate that these people, or at least that there were some people, who actually were just as, if not more successful than him in preaching to the people of Galatia. And the Galatians to whom he's talking are Gentiles. Now, as a colleague of mine who's a real expert in this stuff, Mark Letney, pointed out to me, he says, saying that you write a letter to the Galatians is like saying I wrote a letter to I-95. Right? It's a huge area. It's not clear to whom or to what it's referring. But nonetheless, here's how Paul starts off his letter to the Galatians. So first of all, he says, "Hi, I'm Paul. I'm writing to you again. Remember me." Then he says, "I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting the one who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel." Now, so Paul says, so what does Paul indicate about the people to whom he's writing? What's happened? He taught them stuff, and now what? They left. They're off the derech, right? So now, who are these people who are preaching a different gospel, right? So let me ask you a question. We covered this last semester, but traditional interpreters have seen this as a reference to Jews. This passage, I think, is proof that this is, or is dispositive proof that this is not the case. Because who are the opponents here? The opponents here are people who are teaching Jewish practices.
Yeah.
How does he describe his opponents? They are turning you to what?
Different
a different gospel. So what does that indicate about the opponents? What are they?
Writing a different gospel.
Excellent. They are followers of Jesus. They're just propounding a different version of what that fellowship intends. Okay. Or entails, rather. Then Paul gives us a little bit of a clue who these people were. He says, "Because of false brothers secretly brought in," this is in the next chapter, "who slipped in to spy in the freedom we have in Christ Jesus so that they might enslave us, we did not submit to them even for a moment so that the truth of the gospel might always remain with you. But when Kephas came to Antioch," now Kephas is the Aramaic name for Peter, because Peter is from the Greek word Petros. Petros means rock, and the Aramaic word for rock is Kepha or Kepha. So Kephas is the name that Paul himself uses to refer to Peter. It says, "But when Kephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood self-condemned. For until certain people came from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But after they came, he drew back and kept himself separate for fear of the circumcision faction." Okay. So what is Paul's criticism of Peter? And here Paul is fleshing out who his opponents are. Who are Paul's opponents?
Jews.
Well,
Peter seems to be one of them because he says that he ate with the Gentiles, and Paul seems to sort of
excellent
thought he was Jewish still.
Precisely.
Right, but Jews seem to be, he's complaining that they're playing both sides.
Well, are they Jews? Are they Jews as Jews? It sounds like these people were probably Jews, but were they followers of Jesus? It sounds like they were. Peter certainly was. The ones from James certainly were, right? James was a follower of Jesus, right? So it sounds like Paul is combating people who were followers of Jesus and who undid all of his work amongst whomever the Galatians are, and these people he calls the circumcision faction. Those are precisely the same people, it sounds like, who are referred to in the book of Acts. So we are dealing with a group of people whom Acts wants us to think were sort of completely marginalized at the Council of Jerusalem, whom Paul's own writings testify were, in fact, actually quite successful. So there is a faction or a group, whatever you want to call them, amongst the early followers of Jesus who seem to have taken a different line on the position of Jewish law within the worldview of those who follow Jesus. And these people were those against whom Paul was opposed and who themselves may have opposed Paul, at least if we're to take Paul at his word. So what I want to do now is see if we can identify some textual remnants, texts are in most cases all that we have, some textual remnants of this view. So the first place that I want to look is actually the Gospel of Matthew. So if you happen to be a New Testament historian, you'll know this already, but for those of you at the table who aren't, Matthew is usually known as kind of like the really Jewy gospel. It has a lot of Judaism in it. It kind of knows Judaism really well. Now, the truth of the matter is that I think this is overstated, and Luke, I actually think, knows, I'm persuaded at least, knows Jewish law at least as well as Matthew, and so does Mark. So I think overall, the uniqueness of Matthew in being very Jewish is overstated. Not that Matthew is any less Jewish, but that its uniqueness in this respect has been overstated. But Matthew actually, I think, does take a harder line than the other Gospels in one key respect, and that's in respect of the following passage. So we're going to read a passage from Matthew now, which has a parallel in Luke, but not in Mark, so just to a refresher on how the Gospels interact with each other. So the earliest of the Gospels, we think, are in order, Mark, then Matthew, then Luke. Mark is the earliest of the Gospels. Why we know this, we can get into later, but you're going to have to take me at my word. Mark appears to be the earliest of the Gospels. Matthew and Luke both quote extensively from Mark, or rely on Mark, but they also have many things in common that don't appear in Mark at all and appear to come from another source. And that source, historians usually refer to as Q. Why Q? What does Q stand for, if you remember? Q stands for the German word Quelle. Why? Because this is the poetry of German culture, right? The Germans had to come up, German scholars had to come up with a name for the source upon which Matthew and Jesus drew. Or from which Matthew and Luke drew when they weren't drawing from Mark. They had to come up with a name for this really all-important source. What did they call it? Quelle. Quelle means source. Okay, so there you go. So this passage appears, if I'm not mistaken, to come from Q. And it's a state. Now, Q is a source that appears to have preserved, if it ever existed and wasn't just sort of like an oral tradition, but Q appears to have preserved just sayings of Jesus with minimal context and minimal narrative. And here's one of the sayings that's attributed to Jesus. So Matthew has this: "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have come not to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth pass away, not one letter, not one stroke of a letter will pass from the law until all is accomplished. And therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." Okay, so Matthew is making two crucial arguments here, one of which I think we're going to see elsewhere, but the other is going to be unique in Matthew, or at least amongst the Gospels. What two arguments, if we could lay them out, is Matthew making here?
Go Machmir.
Yes, I think so. But that's a third argument, and I'm glad you pointed it out. Let's get back to that in a second, right? They're saying you should be mach, you should be stringent. But let's put that on hold. We're going to return to it in 20 seconds because that's going to be our next source. But what does Matthew think about Jewish law? If you could sum up his view of Jewish law and to whom it applies.
Jews.
Definitely applies to Jews. That's point number one. Jews have to keep Jewish law.
And it's required to get into heaven.
Right.
Yes.
You can't break one letter of Jewish law.
Precisely.
Until all is accomplished. That's the...
Right, presumably.
Presumably till Mashiach comes.
Right.
Or which is accomplished, or the end of days. Or
right, whatever. Right. So once the end of days is truly here and done with, then who knows what's going to happen, right? And once these texts came to be interpreted, I think not correctly, as having annulled Jewish law or something like that, so this is one of the passages you can really hang your hat on. Until all is fulfilled, well, maybe we're living in that time right now, right? Okay, but not Pshuto Shel Mikra, as we would say, not the simple reading. So point number one is that Matthew, whoever wrote the Gospel of Matthew, and that title doesn't come in the manuscripts until later, but whoever wrote the Gospel of Matthew, we'll just call him Matthew to keep things simple. Matthew thinks if you're Jewish, you have to keep Jewish law. And if you want to be saved, if you want to make it into the kingdom of heaven, into the Mashiach, into the Imos of Mashiach, what do you have to do?
Keep
Jewish law. So in other words, you have to be Jewish.
But you have to be Jewish to get to heaven.
Yeah, in order to get in, right. You got to be Jewish.
Which is
right.
Very contrary to what we believe today.
Well, let's put that on hold for just a second, but that's a good point. I want to come back to that. Now, Luke has a similar saying. And it's unclear which one is the original one, but Luke has a similar saying. So take a look at what Luke has. Luke has, the law and the prophets were proclaimed until John, right? And John is the, John was the John the Baptist, the sort of the forerunner of Jesus. And until John doesn't mean, and now after John it's no good. It's like the Hebrew phrase which you find in Tanakh all the time, ad hayom hazeh, until this very day. It doesn't mean until this day and no further. It means continuing.
Doing this before Jesus?
John the Baptist appears to have been older than Jesus. Yeah, okay. The law and the prophets were proclaimed until John. Since that time, the good news of the kingdom of God is being preached, and everyone is forcing their way into it. It is easier for heaven and earth to disappear than for the least stroke of a pen to drop out of the law. So what claim does Luke make? That the law and the prophets... It's easier for heaven and earth to disappear than for the least stroke of a pen to drop out of the law. So if you are bound by the law, if you're Jewish, do you get to not keep the law anymore?
No,
you have to keep the law. What element does Matthew have that Luke does not have? Right, Luke and Matthew both have not one stroke of the letter can fall out of the law. What does Matthew have after that?
Exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees.
Right. Element number one, it has you have to be firmer than the Pharisees, right? And number two, if you looked in verse 19, therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do this, and teaches others to do the same, will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. Luke does not have that. Luke says the law still applies, so whoever's bound by the law presumably has to keep the law, like Paul, like Jesus. But Matthew goes further. Matthew says anyone who breaks the law, anyone, or who teaches anyone else to break the law, Jew or Gentile, you're done, you're out. So Matthew goes a step further and says you have to keep Jewish law if you want to be in. That seems to be the view, more or less, in broad strokes, of the group that we encountered in the book of Acts, and that to which Paul seems to make oblique reference. People who thought that in order to be in, Jew or Gentile, you had to keep the law, you had to be circumcised, and so on and so forth. Okay.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
This is Matthew speaking in the name of Jesus.
Yes.
So if you assume that Jesus was speaking only to Jews at that time, it doesn't say anything one way or the other about Gentiles.
Well, you might argue that. So I would argue that Matthew is writing in a time when he is aware that there are Gentiles involved, and so that would ultimately have been in his thought process. But even without that, if all that Matthew attributed to Jesus was anyone who I'm talking to today has to keep the law, then fine. But what he says, he goes further than that. He says, and who teaches others to do the same. So presumably, if you teach anybody else to break the law, Jew, Gentile, he doesn't distinguish, you're out. You're out. So I think that gets us a little bit closer. Now, the last one I want to return
to... The law did not apply to non-Jews. In other words, the law didn't say that non-Jews had to be circumcised. That was not the law.
Well, it's on. Well. Again, what he said, but he goes on to emphasize: whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. In other words, if you want to be great in the kingdom of heaven, you do. It does sound like you have to keep the laws. It does sound like you have to keep the laws.
Point, this is addressed to a Jewish audience, not to a Gentile audience.
Well, I would argue that Matthew is addressed to a Jewish audience de facto, because Matthew's view appears to be that you can't be in unless you're Jewish. Anyway, so that's a good point. But I think that actually strengthens the case, right? The idea that Matthew thinks in order to be in, you got to be Jewish, you got to keep the laws. It would seem to me overly casuistic to make the case that that when Jesus says you have to keep the law, you can't teach anyone to break the law, and you can't teach anybody not to keep the law, that what Jesus really meant was all Jews have to keep the law, but Gentiles don't. Especially since we, in other words, because that seems an overly roundabout way of saying just do what Jewish law says, and what Jewish law says for Gentiles to do is nothing. So I think it would be an overly roundabout way of saying that. But we could leave it as a possibility, yes.
In Matthew it says Gentiles achieve grace through faith.
Where does it say that in Matthew?
Not in this passage, but in other parts of Matthew it says that.
That's not a view that's usually ascribed to Matthew. That's not a view that's usually ascribed to Matthew. It's a view that's usually ascribed to Paul. But there, I think Paul has actually been seriously misinterpreted. And the question of what faith versus works is, even using the word faith there, I think is a mistranslation of the word, of the Greek word pistis, which probably is better translated as promise, because it's not a reference to human faith in God. It's a reference to God's own faithfulness, namely the promise that he made to Avram Avinu to redeem all of humanity, all of his offspring, not just the Jewish people. But that's a separate discussion. Let's leave that for now. But I don't think that's relevant here necessarily. The last point I want to get to before we move on is the last point that we raised about the Pharisees. In other words, Matthew here seems to be saying you got to be better than the Pharisees. So does that in some way, I mean, I hope it didn't sound like people were too bothered by that, but does that get you at all? In other words, if Matthew's attacking the Pharisees, which Matthew, first of all, is much more concerned with the Pharisees, even just in a numeric sense, how many times he references them, than any of the other Gospels, I think even combined. But Matthew in chapter 23 goes after the Pharisees, just really gives it to the Pharisees. So does the fact that Matthew, at least from our perspective, sort of inheritors of Chazal's legacy, so does this bother us at all? So I think in a basic sense it should bother us, and in a sort of Sinaschinim sense it should bother us, but we should also note, and here's the point that I want to make, that actually criticism of Pharisees or Pharisaic hypocrisy or what have you is actually something that you can find in rabbinic literature as well. So for example, take a look. It's explicit in the Talmud Bavli, but you don't even have to go as late as the Babylonian Talmud several hundred years later. You can just look at the Mishnah. The Mishnah, a tradition that's attributed to someone who is contemporary with our period, but even if you want to say it's from the early 3rd century, it's not very long after we're talking. Here's the Mishnah in Sota. The Mishnah in Sota tells us, Huhaya Omer, Rabbi Yeshua used to say, Chasid Shota, Rasha Aram, Isha Prusha, Makos Prushim, Hari Elu Machali Olam. That Rabbi Yeshua used to say, these are the sorts of people who undermine the world. A pious fool, a clever villain, a woman who is either a Pharisee or abstinent. It's unclear what the word prusha there means. It's up for dispute, but we'll leave that for now. And makos prushim, the wounds of the Pharisees. So what are the wounds of the Pharisees? So the general way that this passage is interpreted, I think, is basically what we're going to find in the following source that I've given you, which is the Maimonides, or the Rambam's commentary to the Mishnah. Now, the reason I haven't given you a Hebrew here is because the Rambam's commentary to the Mishnah is written in Judeo-Arabic, there are lots of good, very good Hebrew translations, but instead of giving you Hebrew and then translating into English, which is just a translation of a translation, I just gave you the English. Here's what the Rambam says about this passage. He says, the wounds of the Pharisees. So its interpretation is as follows. The sages, peace be upon them, named themselves, and it's not clear why he says named themselves as opposed to were called by other people, but leave that for now, called themselves the Pharisees. Why? On account of their separation from worldly matters, from the depredations, bad deeds, and general pursuit of worldliness characteristic of human society, and their turning to the matters of the world to come into good deeds. So it's good to be a Pharisee in a certain sense if you do it right. But, says the Rambam, there were those whom the sages describe, and this is the Rambam's referring to Gemara in Sota, but the sages also describe people who gloried in this lifestyle of the Prushim, so that others should suppose that they had truly separated from base things and bad deeds, but were themselves base people. And they accepted upon themselves extraneous stringencies, they made themselves conspicuous in their dress in order to mislead people into thinking them more pious than they were. And for this reason, the sages referred to their actions on account of their excesses and their degradation of the Torah because of the sort of obnoxious hypocrisy that they exhibited as wounds, and spoke of the wounds of the Pharisees. So when Chazal referred to the Makas HaPrushim, the wounds of the Pharisees, what they're referring to are people who acted like Pharisees, or who acted like they were better than everybody else, but really just as bad as everybody else. So when Matthew says you should be as punctilious as the Pharisees, but don't be like them, you should be better than them, what Matthew is really saying is something that and we could give other examples, is common parlance in Jewish literature of the course of a period of time. Okay, so this is Matthew. We have one precedent in the book of Matthew. I want to identify not just a source like Matthew that sort of puts forth its own sort of affirmative vision for how to be a follower of Jesus, and it's sort of only indirectly attacks other ways of being a follower of Jesus. I want to find a work that actually goes after other people for following Jesus incorrectly, in the manner in which, and for following Jesus in a manner other than that which something, let's say, like Matthew prescribes. And so here I want to turn to the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation, a little background. So the book of Revelation didn't make it into sort of this kind of arbitrary collection that we call the New Testament, which can refer to a couple different things. Didn't make it in until quite late. There appear to be a couple of reasons for this. One, it was thought to be a little hokey. It's really, the imagery is really confusing, and it's very prophetic, and all the kind of sort of weird things that you think of when you think of sort of the end of days. 666, the name of the beast, 666, the red dragon, all that stuff. If you're on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and you're asked to guess which one it is, Revelation is a really good guess if you don't know the answer. So Revelation is actually attributed, it's one of the few books that's actually attributed, and certainly works of Jewish prophecy in this early period, that's actually attributed to a named figure, as opposed to kind of being put in the mouth of somebody in the past, from this first century. It's attributed to a fellow named John of Patmos. So it's often called the Apocalypse of John, because John describes this as apokalypsis, which is the Greek word for a vision. The book of Revelation is structured, the way it's structured in the beginning is that John receives this prophecy that has to do with Jesus, and it's very oblique, but basically has to do with Jesus and an eschatological scheme, what the Messianic era is going to be like, who are the bad guys, who are the good guys, Rome is a bad guy, people undermining the community from within are bad guys. But the beginning of Revelation is structured as a series of letters to different churches, or probably more accurate word, different congregations, ecclesiae, throughout Asia Minor. And some of them are congregations to which other early Christian writers, whether Paul or Ignatius or whomever, either wrote to or visited, and so on and so forth. So it's an interesting work for that reason. Here's how the book of Revelation sort of defines, in the very middle of the book, its sort of worldview, as it were. After it describes a vision where, and those of you who've seen the movie or read the book, The Red Dragon, that imagery, Red Dragon, comes from this chapter in Book of Revelation. So the dragon is this kind of evil, primordial, satanic being that tries to kill this mother who's given birth to a child who seems to be a stand-in for Jesus. Is unsuccessful in trying to kill the child, but then harries the woman and her followers throughout the world. And the end of that sort of part of the vision comes with this call by the author of the book. Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and hold fast to the faith of Jesus. So, how is Revelation defining its elect, right? It's real, it's core believers. How is it defining them? What do?
They endure.
They endure, they keep the commandments, and what's the last element? It makes it really crystal clear for you. Holds fast to the faith of Jesus. Jesus. Now, there are another way to read this is faith in Jesus, but if you read it faith of Jesus, which is, I think is a tempting reading, it's just saying what the rest of the verse is saying, which is you have to, not necessarily that this is the most compelling reading, but either way, you have to keep the commandments, you have to do what Jesus did. Okay. So Revelation makes it clear that to be in, you got to keep the commandments. That's the rule. Now, Revelation doesn't just stop there. In the section in one of the early sections where it attacks or it discusses the goings on in other congregations that it's interested in throughout Asia Minor, so it talks about the community in Pergamum, and it says the following. And to the angel of the church of there, that should probably be a more accurate translation would be congregation, to the angel of the congregation in Pergamum, write the following. I have a few things against you. You have some there who hold to the teachings of Balaam, who taught Balak. Now, this is, I mean, the whole work is just replete with endless references to Chumash and to Yechezkel, to Yeshayah. I mean, if I read you a line from the book of Revelation, I think I did this last semester. If I read you a line from the book of Revelation and didn't tell you where it was from, I've done this with other classes. People guess Daniel, Yechezkel. I mean, that's what it sounds like. I have a few things against you. You have some there who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the people of Israel, so that they would eat food sacrificed to idols and practice fornication. The word there is pornousai. Pornousai means to engage in porneia. What porneia is a really interesting question. We're not going to deal with it now. But the other one that I do want, because it's a little more complicated,
There was a sexual ritual.
Correct. I think that's what it's referring to, especially in the episode of Balaam. I think you're absolutely correct. But let's focus on the easier one: eating food sacrificed to idols. So first of all, it's pretty clear from the language here that the relevant group that Revelation is concerned with is the people of Israel. Okay, so that's a baseline. But it's attacking people, specific teachers in Pergamum, who appear to be teaching others that they can eat food sacrificed to idols. So who is that? Who would be teaching followers of Jesus that they can eat food sacrificed to idols? So what would be the problem with eating food sacrificed to idols?
Well, that's not the Jewish way.
Mm. Yeah, it appears. I think
it wouldn't be a Christian one either.
Well, it appears.
But they weren't Christian at the time.
Well, it appears to violate Jewish law. Now, what about if you are a Gentile? Maybe you identify as a Jew, which we'll see in a moment, I think, is the case. But let's say...
It's anti-pagan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
correct. I think that may be a better way of putting it. But take a look, in fact, at the passage right next to this from 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians is another one of the letters of Paul, and here's what Paul has to say about eating food sacrificed to idols. He says, "Eat whatever is sold in the meat market without raising any question on the ground of conscience. For the earth and its fullness are the Lord's. If an unbeliever invites you to a meal and you are disposed to go, eat whatever is set before you without raising any question on the ground of conscience. But if someone says to you, 'This has been offered in sacrifice,' namely to an idol, then do not eat it out of consideration for the one who informed you and for the sake of conscience." I mean the other's conscience, not your own. "For why should my liberty be subject to the judgment of someone else's conscience? If I partake with thankfulness, why should I be denounced because of everything, because of that for which I give thanks? So, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do everything for the glory of God. Don't give offense to Jews or to Greeks, to Gentiles, or to the church or to the congregation of God, just as I try to please everyone in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but that of many, so that they may be saved." Limaskana, halacha lemaisa. What does Paul think about whether or not you're allowed to eat food sacrificed to idols? Well, let's assume that nobody's going to be offended.
Well, he's against that per se, but the overriding thought is to be.
Yeah, I think it depends. Let's say nobody's going to care.
Right.
If nobody's going to care, he says, go ahead.
Eat it.
Yeah, he says then no problem. If someone's going to care, then don't eat it. Not because it's wrong, Mikra Adin. Not because it's wrong, ab initio, but because de jure, but because you shouldn't offend people. It's not nice. But Paul thinks Maker Adin, you're allowed, the people that he's talking to are allowed to eat food sacrificed to idols. Now, to whom is Paul talking? Excellent question. I already hear it coming. Paul is talking to Gentiles, as he is in all of his letters. Paul is talking to Gentiles. Now, Paul's position, therefore, is that if you are a Gentile, you don't have to keep the law against, you don't have to abstain from food sacrificed to idols. Now, the question of whether or not that's sort of a consensus position or idiosyncratic, I don't think that it is in the context of Paul's time, but let's leave that aside for a moment. Yeah?
Are the Gentiles the pagans or the Gentiles the Jews that are following Paul?
Pagans whom Paul is trying to bring over to following Jesus.
That's the first time he referred to them as Greeks.
Right, precisely. Now, Paul is referring here to Gentiles whom he wants to be separated from the pagans, but not to become Jews. Because again, Paul doesn't think that if you're a Gentile follower of Jesus, you need to become Jewish. That's Paul's baseline. Now, when Revelation is writing to the congregations in Asia Minor and saying, there are those among you who are teaching you that it's okay to eat food from idols, this is a stumbling block before the people of Israel, to whom is Revelation, maybe not specifically, but people like whom is Revelation referring?
Paul,
I think Paul. At least that's as far as we can tell from our ancient evidence. The people who were teaching those in Asia Minor who were trying to be followers of Jesus that it's okay to eat food sacrificed to idols were people like Paul, or people who were following Paul's teachings, or people who were like Paul. And the book of Revelation says, no, if you want to be part of the in-group, you have to be all the way. You got to be Jewish, you have to keep the commandments, hold fast to the faith of the faith in Jesus, or the faith of Jesus. Don't be a stumbling block before the people of Israel. And to top it all off,
What's the word for commandments? I guess this is Greek.
So nomoi, which the singular would be nomos, or at least in the nominative it would be nomos, which means law, commandments. Now, that in Paul's writings,
And we're assuming when we're reading in Revelation that refers to the whole body of Jewish law and rabbinic law, and not just to.
Well, I'll qualify
not rabbinic law.
Right.
Dibros, which
I'm going
to
leave it. We'll leave out rabbinic law for now because it's not clear what rabbinic law. It's not even clear what rabbinic law looked like at this time, right? But let's assume that sort of the baseline, which we've seen that, you know, over and over again, the baseline for what it meant to be a real full red-blooded Jew at this time was to keep the law, the quote-unquote, the laws of Moses. Now, whatever that meant, this is subject to interpretation, but to keep the laws of Moses. As long as you're affirming that we have to keep the laws of Moses, you seem to have been squarely within the mainstream of Jewish society at this time. Now, what I want to point out is that Revelation actually goes even further and makes its case even more explicit. Take a look at that last.
So this is Revelation. This is like 100 years after.
So Revelation, it's unclear when Revelation is written. There are some people who try to date it quite early, but Revelation is, I would say, the safest thing to say if someone asks you when Revelation was written is probably, or composed, is probably either the end of the first century or beginning of the second century. So
well after Paul's writing Corinthians.
No.
So it's a couple of decades after Paul's writing Corinthians, but it's before the Gospel of Luke, for example, or it seems to be before it to have been written for the Gospel of Luke. It may have been contemporary, more or less, with Matthew or something, possibly something like that. So it's relatively early work. It's not as early as Paul, but Paul, again, is the earliest sources that we have. So Revelation sort of puts the nail in the coffin as follows. Revelation says in the second chapter, "And to the angel of the congregation in Smyrna write the following." This is the instruction that John is getting. "These are the words of the first and the last, who was dead and came to life. I know your affliction and your poverty, even though you are rich. I know the slander on the part of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are instead a synagogue of Satan." So Revelation, what accusation is Revelation making against its opponents? Those who do not keep the commandments, those who are like Balaam, who put a stumbling block before Israel, who eat food sacrificed to idols in contravention of the law. What does Revelation say about them? How does Revelation characterize them? Right, hypocrites, but more than hypocrites, a synagogue of Satan. What makes them a synagogue of Satan? Sort of like a bizarro synagogue, if you will. They say they're Jews, and they are not, because what are they?
Not
he doesn't use the word Christian.
No,
Gentiles, precisely. They're Gentiles. Excellent, right. They're Gentiles. They say that they're Jews, but they're not really Jews. What does that mean that they say that they're Jews?
They're wolves dressed up in sheep clothing.
Right, that it seems to be the impression that Revelation is giving off. They're, they're wolves in sheep's clothing.
Separated out yet. So you either have pagans or you have...
I think you're precisely right. That's why Revelation is using this language. Because Revelation knows that the people that he is opposing, Revelation thinks that they're Gentiles and they're not keeping Jewish law and they're not doing the right thing. But he recognizes that they are claiming sort of continuity with the legacy of biblical Israel, the Jewish people. And so they identify, at least in Revelation's eyes, they're people who want to identify as or with the Jewish people, but they're not really Jews. That's the argument that Revelation is making.
It's like the converse of the Inquisition. So you'd say you're Christians, but you're really Jews.
Right, precisely. It would be something, right? In other words, they're being accused of sort of being a fifth column. Right, exactly.
Yeah, but those are Christians who believe that you have to follow Jewish law and follow the laws of Jesus are really putting...
Well, what are the laws of Jesus?
I don't know, but but whatever it is, or the spirit of Jesus, it's like Mahajan Minimahajan.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that's the way that many of Jesus' teachings should be interpreted. Why do you have to turn? Why do you have to do all these things that seem almost absurd in the context of a common sense moral system? Like turn the other cheek if someone slaps you, give away all your money. It's easier for a camel to pass the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter heaven. Why? Because Jesus, as we've seen in earlier episodes of this, Jesus and Paul and the early followers of Jesus were all convinced beyond the shadow of a doubt that the Messiah was going to, that the Messianic age was going to be ushered in their lifetimes. So during the Yemos HaMashiach, we're all going to live like that. I mean, just read Yeshayahu. That's what the world is going to be like. The lion's going to, Garza Avon Keves, right? The wolf is going to lie down with the lamb. I mean, everyone's going to live like this. If you want to make it into the kingdom of heaven and get the front row seats, you should start behaving as if the kingdom has already come right now. Because it's going to come within this generation anyway. The problem that Paul starts to encounter, again, because he's after Jesus, is that people start to grumble, hey, wait a minute, where's this Messiah? So in 1 Thessalonians, he's already saying, look, it's going to at least be in your children's lifetime, right? And then this, as we're going to see in two classes, this is where the rubber is really going to hit the road. Because as it becomes clearer to people, or as people, as followers of Jesus, slowly begin to recognize that the end is not coming, is not imminent, so then you have to figure out, well, what do we do with all this whole body of teachings? That's going to be one of the major challenges that the early church, to use a loaded term, faces. But the last thing I want to cover here...
The author of Revelations simply did not want Gentiles in the church.
Gentiles as Gentiles appears not to have wanted
them. Non-converted Gentile,
non-circumcised. That's what it seems like, yes.
Did not.
Right, that's what it sounds like. If you want to be in, got to keep the commandments.
What do theologians do with that?
Well, the answer is that for not necessarily for this reason, but I think in part for this reason, for centuries, Revelation was out. Revelation was out. In fact, some of the early figures who were among followers of Jesus, some of the early followers of Jesus that historians will call church fathers or apostolic fathers. When they were writing about the book of Revelation, some of our later evidence, some of the church historians tell us this, there was a large faction of people who claimed that Revelation was a forgery by, I believe, a person named Corinthus, that Revelation was sort of like an ancient forgery, was not to be taken seriously. Eventually, certainly by the sort of late 2nd, early 3rd century, People whom we sort of refer to a little clunkily as Montanists, basically followers of the teachings of a fellow named Montanus and his sort of the other co-prophets with him, whose names I'm going to forget now, but two women who were sort of. They were sort of the three editors-in-chief, as it were, of Montanism. It was sort of a contemporary prophetic movement. They all thought that they were inspired by the Holy Spirit, and they were given access to prophecies that were real bona fide prophecies even in the modern day. And eventually, that these prophecies would clarify some of the... it was thought that these prophecies would clarify some of the things that, John the Baptist said or Jesus said. But in any event, by the time you get to... a fellow named Tertullian, who's an early famous and important, as we're going to see, church writer among the early Christian church in Carthage in North Africa. So by that time, it becomes, by his time, and maybe even a little bit earlier in the city of Rome, it becomes clear that for followers of Montanism, who really believe that prophecy is alive and well, the book of Revelation was a very important text for them. And their opponents, therefore, seem to have sort of contested that. But in any event, where I want to go now, the last stop that I want to make before we wrap it up, is the writings of Justin, Justin Martyr. Justin Martyr is a Gentile. We have, according to his own writings, he was a classically trained philosopher.
He was very anti-Jewish.
Right, and in fact, although in a strange way, right, his magnum opus is the dialogue with Trypho, which is sort of either a real or imagined, probably imagined, but maybe rooted in truth, dialogue between, or imagined, but between himself and a Jew over all sorts of things of belief in Jesus and following Jesus and so forth, how to interpret scripture. So one of the things, the reason why Justin is very important is because Justin gives us the perspective from sort of the later part of the 2nd century CE. So 100 years, more than 100 years after Jesus, that tells us that this tradition, that this sort of strand that we've seen in Matthew in the book of Revelation is alive and well. Here's what he writes in the dialogue. So Trypho, who's this this Pashita Yid, sort of asks Justin the following. He says, "But if some even now wish to live in the observance of the institutions given by Moses, and yet believe in this Jesus who was crucified, recognizing him to be the Christ, the Messiah of God, and that it is given to him to be absolute judge of all, and that his is the everlasting kingdom, can they also be saved? He inquired of me," says Justin. And so Justin goes on to say, well, Justin goes on to have a whole discussion about how the laws of Moses are obsolete, but then Trypho keeps on pressing him, at least according to the dialogue, and Trypho again inquired, "But if someone, knowing that this is so, after he recognizes that this man is Christ, and has believed in him, and obeys him, wishes, however, to observe these institutions," right, the laws of Moses, "will he be saved? So I said," says Justin, "in my opinion, Trypho, such a one will be saved. If he doesn't strive, as long as he doesn't strive in every way to persuade other men, I mean those Gentiles who have been circumcised from error by Christ to observe the same things as himself, telling them that they will not be saved unless they do so. This you did yourself at the commencement of the discourse," and so on and so forth. So Justin is saying, what is Justin saying?
This was resolved in Vatican II.
Right, but it took a long time. So here, what is Justin saying? If you are if you want to be a follower of Christ, you can even be a Gentile, and you decide you want to keep the laws of Moses. What's the maskana? What's the law? Fine, nishkeferlach. But as long as you're not trying to spread this, it's fine. So Justin, now, this would cease to be the consensus. This would cease to be a popular opinion, and it kind of disappears from the sources that we have in the subsequent centuries, but we have other sources where people are actually advocating that you have to keep the commandments, even later sources. We'll get to those at a later point. But Justin is telling us that even 100 years, more than 100 years, 130 years, 150 years, after Jesus is gone, you still have a strong tradition of people who are followers of Jesus, who think you have to keep the law, think you have to be circumcised, and so on and so forth. Okay, why do we care about any of this? So I think the reason we care is as follows. There's a tendency in some of the historical writing, and I think when people sort of discover the Jewiness of Matthew, or the Jewishness of Matthew, as it were, there's a tendency to kind of see this strand, right, this everyone has to keep Jewish law is still the overriding concern. I think Jews have a tendency to see this as sort of, these as our representatives amongst the early followers of Jesus. These are the good guys. And the reason, I think, is because sort of the history of Christianity and Christians and the role that Jews played in there has traditionally been a field or been an area of inquiry that for centuries has been construed in such a way as to marginalize Jews and to become and to be a hostile and antagonistic towards Jews. Yeah. It's a place that's hostile to Jews. So I think for Jews to be able to sort of discover some real Judaism in early Christianity is almost like a thrill of the forbidden. And I think that's why there's a tendency to see them as the good guys. But what I want to do here is we're sitting here in shul, or at least we're sitting here above shul, and we're in a safe place, as it were. And I want us to take seriously, not as people who have to sort of represent ourselves in the academy or in a seminary or wherever, just together as believing Orthodox, just practicing Orthodox Jews. What does this mean to us? And I think my sense, and you'll have to tell me what you think about this, my sense is that we should not be viewing the Matthews, the Revelations, the whomever Justin's talking about of the world as the good guys, because it is precisely their view of God's plan that is...
Being able to create the myth.
Precisely, it is precisely this view that is morally absolutist. And it is premised, the notion that in order to really be valuable in God's eyes, because at the end of the day, once the end of days is here, that's when the game is up. That's when we stop playing games about what we're doing in Olam Hazeh. That, when Olam Haba is the what's the name that we nowadays use to refer to Olam Haba? The Olam HaEmes. The Olam HaEmes, the world of truth. When we get to that point, who's really going to be valuable? That's when we're really going to find out. According to this strain of interpretation, it's only going to be the Jews. This sort of theology, I think, requires such a degree, an inappropriate degree of certainty about what our covenant with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is all about. It requires us to be so certain that we understand that covenant, that we can extrapolate from its existence amongst Jews in the here and now, in Olam Hazeh, to everybody in Olam Haba, that at the end of days, our covenant is so self-evidently important for everybody to be a part of, that at the end of the days, unless you relate to God in exactly the way that we relate to God, you're worthless. In fact, I think this is completely out of concert with everything that Chumash has to say about our bris with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So think for a moment. In Yana Diyoma, some of the past couple of parshiyos that we've read, why does God, and Avraham, as we've seen, as we saw in previous classes, is a pivotal figure, at least in Paul's theology. Why does God choose Avraham? Because he's so wonderful? Because he was an early monotheist? Because he destroyed the idols in Terach's shop? But these are all things that Chazal say, because I think Chazal are just as perplexed by this question as we are. The answer is Tanakh, all of Tanakh, Chumash, Neviim, Ksuvim, never, ever tells us. All we know is that God approaches Avraham and tells Avraham, we are going to make a bris together. Do you accept these terms? Avraham says yes. The message self-destructs, and almost quite literally, because revelation dissipates, and that is that. We are bound because we are committed to the covenant that our forefathers and foremothers made, and that we continually affirm in every generation. We are committed to that covenant because God instructed us. We don't know why we were chosen. All we know is what we were chosen for. And what we were chosen for is to follow Hashem's commandments, cultivate a relationship to God, model what it to the rest of the world as an Orla Gayim, what it means to cultivate a relationship with God and live a just, kind, and godly life. That's what we have to do. Why do we have to do this? That is beyond our ken. So far beyond our ken, that in the world to come, in the Olam Haba, Chas V'Shalom, that we should say, Chas V'Shalom, that's a little too strong. But I think it's far beyond us to be people who say, unless you're exactly like us and have exactly the same relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu that we have, you are worthless, you are dirt. Chas V'Shalom, that we should say such a thing. And in fact, by saying this, I don't even want to let Paul off the hook. Because Paul, of course, is the one who says this. You don't have to keep Jewish law if you're a Gentile. And in that respect, I think, as we've seen in previous classes, Paul fits within sort of what we would later call sort of the mainstream of rabbinic thought, Hasidi Umas HaOlam, and so on and so forth. But even Paul suffers from the same sort of absolutism as the strain that we're talking about, just in a different realm. Because Paul is absolutely convinced that he knows when the Yemos HaMashiach is going to come. And Nistaros LaHashem Elokeinu Ula Paul. Paul knows exactly all the hidden things, the things that are to come. Paul knows all of those things. So Paul, again, I think, is a model of the sort of absolutism that we are trying to avoid. So if there's any lesson to take away from this chapter in Jewish history, the Gospel of Matthew, the Book of Revelation, the dialogue with Trypho, it is that we want and should, if we are true B'nai Avram Avinu and B'nai Bris, What we should be cultivating is a sense of humility and a sense of faithfulness, as well as a sense of humility about our faithfulness. And with that, I'm going to dismiss you. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to take them. All right, Yasha Kach, everybody.